Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoeffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. We gratefully acknowledge contributions to sustain the Infrastructure Show from Dr. Robert Peskin, Dr. Raymond Ellis, and Andrea and Ron DeFeo. Many U.S. cities are anxious to establish and to extend their rail transit systems, but the cost of these projects can make them unaffordable or can put the best design concepts out of reach. Are the costs of rail transit in the United States in both money and time really excessive? The Eno Center for Transportation, which is an independent, nonpartisan transportation think tank in Washington, D.C., addresses that question in a recent study. To tell us about the study and what we can learn from it, we're talking with one of the co-authors, who's Paul Lewis. Paul is Vice President for Policy and Finance of the Eno Center. Welcome to the podcast, Paul.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So what were your objectives in conducting this study?
So about 2 years ago, we decided to tackle this study of looking at the high costs and long timelines associated with U.S. rail transit projects. First, to figure out, Does a premium in the U.S. exist, right? Is there a kind of systemic thing associated with U.S. rail transit projects? And what is causing that, if that's the case? And importantly, what can we do about it as a country from a public policy standpoint to make sure that when we are investing, we're getting our best bang for our buck, and we can extend those dollars and those transit lines further with the limited resources that we have.
So that's a big reach. How did you do it? What was the method that you used?
So we started with the first question, right? Do we have a systemic problem with costs and timelines in the country? And we collected data points of all rail transit projects built in the last 25 years here in this country. And we started collecting data in other countries. And some of this was leveraged from existing data sources that are out there. And we expanded it. We looked at both heavy rail and light rail. We looked primarily at comparable countries from a governance standpoint, meaning the U.S. and Canada and Europe. We expanded that eventually to include other places around the world, like South Korea and Japan and South Africa, other places in Northern Europe and Eastern Europe that have built rail transit that are comparable. And we took that data, we looked at, there's a bunch of different data points. It's all available, right? People can download it and use it. And there is a cost premium. If you look at the whole U.S., it's at least 50% on a per mile basis, controlling for things like percent tunneled and different types of modes. And that can grow in some of the more expensive regions in the country, particularly in New York, but also in places in California where that cost premium is two or three times more than international peers.
So, excuse me, but were you able to account for differences in wage rates or price indices across these countries?
Yeah, and that's where it is hard to get a perfect apples-to-apples comparison. We did adjust for inflation using producer price indices. We did adjust for purchasing power parity, so not just a foreign currency conversion, but a PPP conversion to help make it a little bit more comparable to U.S. costs. But there are some countries have lower wage rates, but then that's where we felt like the comparison to Europe was useful because they do have wage rates that are fairly similar to here in the U.S.
And you also did some specific case studies, is that right?
That's right. So it's not enough to figure out, you know, is there a premium? What we then did is we spent a lot of time digging into a couple cases. And not of specific projects, but more in specific regions and how they deliver their projects, and trying to find some things that may be threaded through and help explain why things are so costly and what we can do about it. And so in the U.S., we looked at projects in Los Angeles, Seattle, Denver, and Minneapolis. Internationally, we looked at Toronto, Copenhagen, Madrid, and Paris. And we also included a highway comparison where we looked at the Silver Line extension in Northern Virginia and compared that to the 495 hot lanes to try to get a sense of whether the cost differential and the issues were transit-specific or U.S. infrastructure-specific. And so through those case studies, we learned a lot about what is at the root of a lot of the problems in the U.S. in terms of delivering these big projects and what are some ways we can go about addressing it.
And you found, as you said, that we do pay a premium.
Yep, absolutely pay a premium. Pretty consistent. Of course, there's a few projects that are pretty low cost. But by and large, we pay at least 50% more on a per project, per mile basis to build rail transit in this country.
So one of the things I found interesting in reading your study, you talk about the consequences of that premium. That is what that premium has on the product that we get. Can you develop that idea a bit for us?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you're paying a lot more for transit, you build less of it. But I think one of the other important consequences is that it forces planners and engineers to design suboptimal systems. And those of us that follow transit and transit projects know that a lot of the new facilities are built in highway medians and on underutilized freight rail right-of-way. And in some cases, particularly with the freight rail right-of-way, that can make sense, particularly if it's going through dense urban neighborhoods. But more often than not, those types of routes are actually not where all the people are. It's not where the density is. It's not where the real need is. But it's a lot easier. And because of the complexities that exist in building these projects, we see boards and transit agencies opting for the easier and then less expensive route. And we end up with a transit product that's not as useful as it could be. Because it's bordering a giant freeway or it's going through an industrial part of the region.
So I find that particularly important as a finding because what it says is we're focused on cost minimization in a situation where costs are very high rather than benefit maximization to get the most value out of the investment. Is that a reasonable perspective?
Yeah, and there's a couple things we need to do to address that. I mean, one, we need to take on and kind of recognize across the board that we have a problem. We need to take it seriously, and we need to take a multifaceted approach. And we can talk about some of the recommendations we have to do that. And then we also need to hold our projects to a higher standard. And this is where the FTA can play a pretty big role in making sure that some of that's part of the CIG process in order to get some federal grants. And looking at things beyond just ridership projections, but accessibility and access, things that really matter to riders so that we are building transit in the right way and also doing it in a way that can be more cost effective.
So it seems like, as you describe it, you're laying out two options for us to follow in this discussion. One is, what are the causes? And the other is, what do we do about it? And so maybe a way to pursue this is to talk about what we should do about it, and that'll lead us into the causes.
Yeah, because they're obviously very much related. You know, when we tried to figure out what the problem is, of course, it's not just one or two things. There's a myriad different issues that come up, and cumulatively, they create a situation where we're paying for a lot more for transit than we should. And so I think we need to think about it in that kind of holistic terms. In our paper, we divided those issues and potential solutions into three main buckets. The first is governance, and this is how we structure our projects, the institutions, the staff, the authorities that those institutions have to deliver things. We need to rethink the governance piece, and that's a critical component. We'll talk a little bit about that. The second area is the processes, how we get things done. All right, this isn't just the NEPA environmental review process, but it's community engagement, it's utility relocation, it's planning for neighborhood disruptions during construction. Those kind of things are critical to reform and revise. And then finally is standards. And we talked about this a little bit earlier, with kind of holding our projects to a higher standard, building better projects. But it's also not trying to over-customize every single thing. Standardization is something that we've seen employed in a lot of other regions. And, you know, not having to create a new, completely new design for every station or every rail car is a huge benefit to transit agencies. And so the standard side of things is critically important.
So talk about governance. What are the issues and how should we address them?
So in terms of governance, right, this is where we have to really focus on the institutions. And I think too often we rely on a transit agency. And a transit agency in this country typically is an operating entity that once a decade or two, we decide, hey, go build a giant mega project. And those agencies, both from a culture, a staff capacity, and a board structure standpoint, aren't really designed to build massive projects. And so we need to either look at reforming that institution or creating a new institution that is some kind of construction authority or special purpose delivery vehicle that is specifically designed to build these kind of projects, coordinating, of course, with transit agencies and other in the region. And so what that means is that that institution, again, whether it's a capital division at a transit agency or a new institution, needs to have authorities over permitting. They need to have the ability to hire top-level staff. They should be able to do things like issue debt and apply for federal grants, right? And a lot of the things that are part of building a project in coordination with the existing groups that are in the region. And then they need to leverage some of the expertise at other agencies that have done this before, whether that's the Federal Transit Administration, whether that's highway departments or the Federal Highway Administration, right? There's lots of resources that these entities can use and not necessarily rely on consultants to do project management work and do a lot of that in-house with expertise that they brought on. And so those are all things that I think are pretty critical on the governance side. And we usually don't think about those at the very beginning of the project. And it's really important that we focus on them.
Well, it's very interesting to hear that because, no, we don't think about creating a new entity to do this big project. We make an assumption that the existing organization can do it. Do you envision the possibility that there's a kind of roving band of experts that move from project to project and take these on and then go on to the next one as opposed to, say, staying in one place?
Yeah, and I think that there already are. I mean, if you look at project management folks that work at agencies, I mean, a lot of them have experience working on big transit projects all over the country, right? And so there's a group of those people. One of the issues is that a lot of transit agencies, as publicly owned institutions, have salary caps. And so what ends up happening is that the top talent goes to consulting firms. They don't have the capacity from a salary standpoint to bring those folks on. And so we're in order to access that top talent, we have to rely on consulting, which consultants do great work. This is not a knock on consultants by any means, but there is a difference. And this is something we've seen in other countries where they almost always have the project management staff are hired by the public institution. And this is where, too, in our case studies in Paris and Madrid and in Copenhagen, they created a new institution designed specifically to build these big projects. And those institutions, I think, were well equipped because that is their mission, to build this project. Sometimes they go away after the project's done. Sometimes they become the transit agency. But there's lots of different models. But we see that third-party institution more frequently abroad.
Interesting, different, and a cultural difference, really. My sense is that if the salary cap in an agency forces the agency to go to a consultant, they probably pay more for the product.
Yeah, and it's not so much, I mean, certainly consultants are expensive, right? And there's an additional cost there. And it's also just, you know, who does that person actually work for? Who is their true loyalty to? Who's, you know, what name, what organization's on their paycheck? And that matters as well. But yeah, I don't think we're necessarily saving any money by using consultants. But agencies have these restrictions on how much they can pay their top staff, and that causes problems from a talent standpoint.
When you talk, I'm just looping back to the phrase you use, special purpose delivery vehicles. What you're really talking about is putting the management of the project in the hands of experts, the people that know how to do this.
In some respects, and look, there's a lot of experts at capital divisions of transit agencies, particularly ones that have big capital programs. But, you know, one example, let's talk about California and Los Angeles. We saw in L.A. the Gold Line and the Expo Line were built by independent construction authorities, the two separate ones, where that organization's sole mission was to build that specific project. They were created to do that. All of the staff, all of the board was structured around the project. There were certainly tensions. They work closely with LA Metro. There's some tensions back and forth between the agency and the construction authority. But those were some of the lower cost projects in the region. And some of that, I think, is because of the governance. Some of it's from a lot of other things that we could go into. So we do use those occasionally here in this country. But what we've seen looking at other countries where they do it more often, it's more focused on the benefits, really focused on the fact that institution is wholly in charge of that project. And that's the only thing that they're worried about.
If I understand what you wrote in the report, these institutions also centralize responsibilities for critical activities in implementing the projects.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, there's lots of different ways to divide roles and responsibilities, but they do have a lot of control over the project specific. Mm-hmm.
So what about the second category you listed, which is processes? What do you recommend there? What are the issues?
Yeah, so we looked at a whole bunch of different processes. You know, of course, everyone likes to talk about NEPA and environmental permitting. You know, I think that we actually found that most other countries have an environmental law that's pretty similar to ours. I don't think that NEPA needs to be completely upended or thrown out. We recommend perhaps piloting some exemptions for environmentally beneficial projects like transit from some of the things under the environmental review. But ultimately, I think what happens is we end up placing too much of the planning decision-making process onto the environmental review. So they become overly complex, and they have dozens, in some cases, of alternatives where in reality, some of those decisions should have been made with the community in the planning process and have a lot fewer alternatives evaluated in the environmental review. So there's some discussion about that. I think more importantly is kind of that the community engagement piece, right? We don't do that very well here in this country. I think for two reasons. One, I don't think we invest enough in it. There's a couple places where there is a lot of community engagement, and there's some models there where they dedicate full-time staff to different portions of the line throughout planning and construction, right, to liaise with the businesses and residents. That's really important. We have to be better investing in our community engagement side of things so that people feel heard. And the feedback is transparent, but, and this is the important but, we have to empower agencies and their staff to say no, right? Because sometimes community demands are at a lot of cost to the project. And through that transparent process, we have to say, look, we hear you, but we're not going to do that right now in this project, and here's why. And we defer so much. We place a high value on making everybody happy, and that is to the detriment of project timelines and costs. And so ultimately, we do need to empower agencies to make those really tough decisions, and that is such a critical component. And I think it's not just like, well, where do you put the station and the entrances, but it's also how do you manage construction? And too often, we saddle these construction projects with very, very tight work windows. You got to make sure that the roads can be open for for traffic and businesses open during construction, right? And some of that stuff is you need to take care of and make sure it's managed properly. But in Europe and other places, they take the rip the Band-Aid off approach. And they're like, look, we're going to be highly disruptive. We're going to shut down streets. We're going to take away your parking. We're going to do all this stuff, and it's going to be miserable. And then we're going to be gone in a couple weeks, right? And so they in other countries, they save a lot of money and time by taking that approach rather than the U.S., where we go on for months and months and months because we're trying to make everyone happy and we're trying to minimize disruption.
Interesting point, and I think a difficult one to sell because everybody wants to determine what the experience is going to be, what the product's going to be. But what I get from your report is that threatens the overall quality of the product that you get in the end.
Well, right, and it makes it just very, very expensive. And it's not to say that we shouldn't be listening to communities, right? We have to be doing a better job of that.
But there's some interesting European examples, particularly in the Netherlands, as they approach flood control, that we are listening to what you're saying in the communities. But in the end, we have to address the problem. We have to solve the problem.
Yeah.
I want to take you back. You made one point that you make in the report is addresses the concept of using the selection of the lowest bidder as a criterion for project decision making. Where does that fit in? What are you recommending there?
Yeah, that's going back to one of the governance issues, and it's a lot of people talk about lowest bid and whether something should be design bid build or design build or CMGC, right? There's lots of different procurement options that kind of fall under that governance category. We found it actually doesn't really matter. We couldn't find any correlation between the type of procurement and project outcomes. The two things that do matter is, one, does the agency actually understand the procurement method, their respective role versus the private perspective role, and do they manage it accordingly, right? That's a crucial, crucial thing. And the other thing is, how are they selecting their contractors? And too often here in the U.S., either by law or by agency policy, we chase the lowest bidder, whereas in every other country, there's much greater emphasis on the best quality of the bid. And there's usually some kind of matrix where cost tends to be less than 50% of the overall evaluation criteria, much more emphasis on experience and qualifications and timeline approach. And that kind of, you get what you pay for, and you're going to pay for it one way or the other. So, you know, if you go after the lower bidder, you might not get the type of quality or the type of experience that you need. And so through change orders and other delays, you end up paying for it anyway.
So what's been the reaction from policymakers and planners to your study and your findings?
Yeah, I think it's been generally positive. Of course, there's always more questions than we're able to answer. And I think that we've been engaged with a lot of communities, a lot of transit agencies around the country that are trying to crack this nut. And I think there's a growing, first, a realization that we've got to do something about it. I think for a long time, it was flying under the radar. People knew that costs were going up, but not really paying attention to it. And so now there's a much greater emphasis at agencies to try to handle this and get a handle on it from the very beginning. And so, you know, we're in a phase now where we're talking with individual communities and agencies around the country about how they can proactively be addressing this, particularly in light of the new infrastructure bill that was passed a few months ago, a lot of money for transit. Most of what we've been focusing on is new projects, and I think there'll be some of those. But a lot of that money will be for rehabilitation and kind of major repairs, which is also super critical. And I think a lot of the lessons that we have in our paper apply to those kind of projects as well. And again, it's just kind of going back to that, what's needed in each community, and that's where we're really trying to engage directly and help make sure that these recommendations end up in the hands of the right people.
That direct engagement surely is a path to success. That is, the people that are making these investments and making these decisions need to understand what you found and what they can do in response. Paul, it's a fantastically interesting study. We'll put a link on it in our website. I really appreciate your sharing these insights with us this morning. Thanks very much for being with us.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to The Infrastructure Show. If you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did, please subscribe to our podcast and encourage your friends to join us too. The Infrastructure Show is recorded at the Studio Media Recording Company in Evanston, Illinois, under the direction of Scott Steinman, recording engineer with a commitment to great sound. Our producer is Marion Sowers, a journalist with a passion for infrastructure. And I am Professor Joseph Schoeffer. Few people are more curious about infrastructure than I am.